Yeah, thank you very much. So it's a great honor to give this opening talk. It's about 7 years I have been last time here, and so this is a new room for me. So now it's quite a challenge to introduce a field which is material-based in a Blackboard talk, and so I try to do my best so really to convey the more standard aspects of these unconventional superconductors, and then right after me we will hear about the more exotic aspects of chiral p-wave state for topological quantum computing. So I have put the title of my presentation as chiral p-wave superconductivity in strontium 2 Plutonium 4, so we will see that the something, which we heard before, is actually the important part. The strontium is just giving the charge. So strontium ruthenium oxide was early on recognized as a really extraordinary material for unconventional superconductivity. Possibly a textbook case for unconventional superconductivity, because if it's really this chiral p-wave state which is realized there, then this may be the electronic analog of helium-3, superfluid helium-3, which has kept people busy since its discovery with many exciting things. And actually, helium-3 was the first system where you found unconventional Cooper pairing, and so helium-3 is a superfluid, but it's also strongly correlated Fermi liquid, and so these two properties make this system a very exciting thing. So now, I mentioned the term unconventional, and so let me first really introduce what I mean by unconventional. So what means the term unconventional superconductivity? And so you all know that superconductivity is due to Cooper pairing. If we have here the Fermi sphere, we take electrons with momentum k, spin s, momentum minus k, spin s prime, so that these two electronic states form a pair, and the total momentum in the ground state should be zero. That's the condition which we give, and then these Cooper pairs form a coherent state, and in the end we find that we have a finite expectation value for this off-diagonal fermion annihilation operator term. So this can be viewed as a kind of wave function of the Cooper pairs, which we can separate into an orbital part, which is k-dependent, and a spin part. Now it's so that the electrons which pair are, of course, identical fermions. And so Pauli tells us that the wave function here should be totally antisymmetric under exchange of the two particles. So if I exchange the two particles, then k goes into minus k, and I exchange the two spins. And so under this condition, we require that here there should be a minus sign. This allows us now to do a first classification of possible pairing states. And so now the question is how to use this blackboard efficiently. But so let's do this classification. And this classification deals with, can everybody see that when I write down here? Okay. Yeah. So we look at phi of k, and we look at the spin part of the wave function. And so for this part, we can look at a state with even parity. This means if you look at the relative angular momentum, the relative angular momentum should be an even number. Then in order to satisfy this constraint here that we should have a minus sign under particle exchange, then the spin wave function has to change the sign. And so you all know that this should then be a spin singlet state, where if we exchange the two spins, we get relative minus sign. The other possibility is odd parity, and so we would have an odd relative angular momentum of the two electrons, and then the spin, and so here then we would have the minus sign in the orbital part, and so the spin part should be even under exchange of the spins, and so this gives us a triplet pairing state. So now we have here basically for a spherical symmetric system where we can define the angular momentum, we have listed all the possible pairing states. And so now among these there is one which is the most symmetric one, and this one I call conventional. So that is the state with L equals 0 and S equals 0. So this is basically structureless Cooper pair, and that's what BCS in their famous work in 1957 introduced. And the unconventional is now everything else. Now, if I have Cooper pairs forming a condensate, then one thing which immediately comes up is that we have a change in the quasi-particle spectrum. And so in the normal state, the energy of the quasi-particle, that's just a simple band energy. Here I introduce psi of k as the band energy, so the energy depending on k, relative to the chemical potential. So it's zero right at the Fermi surface. Now, in the superconducting state, this spectrum acquires a gap and has then this form with a gap function here. This is a gap function generally k dependent. And so what happens actually here is the following. You have here energy, you have here k. Now let me just do the most simple thing for a spherical Fermi surface. So our spectrum would look like something like this. Crossing the Fermi level here, the energy is zero at Kf. This is the electron-like state, but now you can also represent the same thing by hole-like states. And what the superconducting phase is doing is it is hybridizing electron and hole-like states and opening here a hybridization gap. And so the spectrum which we have in the superconducting phase looks somehow like this. And so here we have a gap that's two times this delta. And of course, you immediately see that if we have this hybridization gap and we go, for example, at zero to zero temperature, we would fill only the states below energy zero, and we would have here an energy gain, which is a part at least of the gained energy in the superconducting state. So now we have here this gap, and this gap is of course something which we can use to characterize the superconducting phase. And so in general, if we assume that we have both possibilities, singlet and triplet pairing, this gap function has to be a matrix, in a 2x2 matrix in spin space. So delta K is given by the delta up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. All these matrix elements, of course, are momentum dependent. And this gap here, as it comes in here, is nothing but one half the trace of this matrix product of the adjoint and the matrix itself. Now, so here you can basically now incorporate into this gap function any spin configuration, but there are some convenient notation for even and odd parity. And so if I look at even parity, so the spin singlet case, then this gap matrix is given by a simple scalar function like that, and so you see, you immediately recognize the spin singlet structure. Up down minus down up is incorporated here. This function psi of k is now the gap function, and it is an even function of k. And if I look at the gap in square, that's nothing but the square modulus of this psi. Now for odd parity, we have spin singlet, spin triplet, and so we have three spin states. And so it is a tradition now to represent these states by a so-called D vector. And so this D vector has three components. And it represents the different matrix elements in this way. This D vector is a function of K, is an odd function of K actually. And if I write down the gap modulus in square, then this is nothing but the modulus of the magnitude of this D in square. There are exceptions to that. The non-unitary states have here some additional corrections. Non-unitary states are, for example, found in helium-3 in a magnetic field, but we won't look at these. Now, this D vector represents the orientation of the D vector represents the spin, and it has the nice feature that when we make a spin rotation, then I can represent the spin rotation as a 3D rotation of the D vector. And so in that sense, it's very convenient to deal with that. It's actually also so that if you look at the spin orientation of the Cooper pairs, that's usually perpendicular to the D vector. This is not all in every case. You cannot in every case write it in that way, but basically what you have to keep in mind is that the D vector is, so the spins in the Cooper pair are for a certain, at least for a certain K value, are always pointing in perpendicular to the real, to the D vector orientation. So now, let us, in this language, just quickly look at helium-3, which I introduce as the first example of an unconventional pairing. And so helium-3, it is recognized to be a superfluid with Cooper pairing in the L equal 1, S equal 1 channel. So it's unconventional. It's a spin triplet. P wave, if we look at L equal 1, so that we basically call now P wave according to the names we give to different angular momenta. Now, helium-3 has a phase diagram which looks roughly like this. This is in the millikelvin range, so very low, 1, 2. And here we have pressure in bars, and so here we have roughly 30. So this up here, if you press too much helium-3, it becomes solid. But down here, it is fluid. Here, it's normal. And in here, it's superfluid, and it has two phases. One is the B phase, the other is the A phase. And these two phases are, in their symmetry, very different. So So the A phase can be represented by a D vector, which is pointing along the C axis and has this momentum structure. Sorry, that's not a vector. There's kx plus I, ky, or kx minus I, ky. Ky times delta naught to give the magnitude. If you now look at the magnitude of the gap, you find this is delta naught squared kx squared plus ky squared if you represent it on spherical coordinates, then this is sine theta, and you see if I plot here, this is xy axis, this is the z axis in also kx or kz, then I have here the Fermi surface. And so what I see is that the gap is zero on two poles, so we have point nodes, and otherwise it is finite largest at the equator. One interesting thing, and we will talk much more about this later for transmutation, is this has an angular momentum pointing along the z-axis, plus or minus 1. Here we have a definite direction of the d-vector. It's always the same. It doesn't depend on the k-value. This is also called ABM state, the Anderson-Brinkmann-Morell state, with just named after the people who introduced it. The B phase is different. The B phase has the structure. The x component is kx, the y component is ky, and the z component is kz times delta naught. So this is a d vector which on the Fermi surface looks like a hedgehog. Also, always the d vector points outside. And if you now look at the gap here is just isotropic. And so, drawing the figure here again for the Fermi surface, so we have an isotropic gap without nodes. There's no node in any direction. Now, this is also called the BW phase. That's the Ballion-Werthammer phase, and which was already introduced long before actually helium-3 was found to be superfluid. And it's actually, for a spherical system, spherically symmetric system, it's the most stable state. And so you see, it also takes up most part of the phase diagram. Here, this phase, the A phase, is actually stabilized by spin fluctuation, so you have to drive the system into a regime where spin fluctuations are important. So this state is most stable because, as I told you before, actually we gain energy by opening the gap. And any nodes which we do, of course, reduce the gained energy. And so if the gap has no nodes, then it's best. So now, how about the superconductors? So the first superconductors which have been identified as unconventional are, I think, the heavy fermion superconductors. And so systems are like, so here are like uranium barium 13 or uranium platinum 3 and so on. Others are then the organics, which have been found at similar time but were recognized as being possibly unconventional only later. And then, of course, in 86, so these came around the beginning of 80s. In 86, then the cuprates came up and, of course, dominated the field of unconventional superconductivity. And the cuprates are nowadays known to be even parity, L equal 2, if you are allowed to use L in a crystal lattice. It's the so-called dx squared minus y squared state. We represent it here with a psi function, which is kx squared minus ky squared. Now, let me come to strontium ruthenate, actually, to our topic. So strontium ruthenium oxide is actually a product of the high temperature superconductivity era. So people had tried to find other transition metal oxide superconductors, which hopefully would have also high TC. And so one of the first was this material strontium ruthenium oxide. It has actually, if you look at the crystal structure, it's a so-called layered perovskite structure. This means we have layers of ruthenium oxide. They form square lattices. These ruthenium ions are sitting in oxygen octahedra. From layer to layer, they are shifted. And in between here is the strontium. So the electronic properties are dominated, so the low energy electronic properties are dominated by this ruthenium oxide layers. And so if you look at this structure, you actually see that this is exactly the same as the lanthanum copper oxide system, which is a parent compound of high temperature superconductors. However, if you look at this material, this has copper as copper 2 plus, and so you have a 3D9 configuration. You have one hole per lattice side, and so the correlation effects make these into a so-called charge transfer insulator. And so you have to change the chemical composition here. You can, for example, put in here strontium, dopamine strontium for lanthanum. Lanthanum would also be here, where in the strontium copper oxide the strontium is. And then you introduce carriers which go into the copper oxide planes, actually into the oxygen P levels. And so then this system becomes metallic and eventually a high temperature superconductor. In strontium ruthenium oxide, ruthenium comes in as ruthenium 4 plus, and so you have a 4D4 configuration. This means we have 4 D electrons. They go in this environment. We have a splitting of the D levels into so-called EG and T to G. They are all going into this 3 orbitals, and so if they disperse, they form 3 bands, 3 electronic bands. It's metallic in its stoichiometric composition as it stands here. It's a Fermi liquid. However, the layering here makes the system very two-dimensional. So if you look at the Fermi surfaces, you have basically cylindrical Fermi surfaces, two electron-like and one hole-like pocket. And so there is very little dispersion along the C-axis. So this is really a quasi two-dimensional Fermi liquid, strongly renormalized. So if you look at the renormalization factors, actually these renormalizations look very similar to the strongly correlated Fermi liquid helium-3. And so this early on gave the idea that actually we encounter here similar physics as we encounter in helium-3. And so the question, of course, was then what is the superconducting state which we find in here? And the superconductivity actually was found by the group of Yoshi Maeno in collaboration with IBM Ruchlikon, actually with Georg Bednorz, who has found the cuprate superconductors together with Alex Müller. And so they found superconductivity, and so the maximal TC we know nowadays is 1.5 Kelvin. This is, of course, a disappointment if you look for high-temperature superconductivity. However, in view of the fact that there may be some similarity with helium-3, of course, it's nevertheless an exciting discovery. And so now the question is, if we look at this here, do we have really unconventional superconductivity? And early on, people found actually that if you have if you look at disorder effects in this material, so if you look at impurities, what you find is actually Tc as a function of the residual resistance, and the residual resistance is roughly proportional to the density of impurities which you have in, Tc drops down to zero, and then stays zero. Now, this is an unexpected feature for a superconductor if it's conventional. There is a theorem called Anderson's theorem. It's actually rather a rule than a theorem. So Anderson's theorem tells us if we have a conventional superconductor which has a gap function which doesn't depend on direction, then impurities do not harm it, at least if you don't have too many of them. Because what impurities do is they destroy the memory of momentum direction. And so they spread out, so to say, the wave function of the electrons over the whole k-space. And so you would average over the gap function in k-space. And so if your gap function vanishes, of course, this would be detrimental to superconductivity. So if we have a gap function which has, so for example, such a phase structure like the D-wave superconductor in high Tc material, then of course this would, if you average over momentum, this would cancel, and so you would destroy superconductivity. And that's exactly what happens in strontium ruthenate. Tc goes down. It follows actually what you would predict theoretically. Now this drop here, the zero is reached when you have a mean free path of roughly 1,000 angstroms. This is huge for material. And so this means you have to make your materials very clean in order to get superconductivity in this system. So let me now come to the possible pairing states. Now we already drew the connection to helium-3, and so let us look at possible superconducting states in the odd parity, so L equal 1 basically, channel for this material. Now in this material we have, as a basic symmetry, we have a tetragonal crystal lattice. This is given by a point group D4H. We have spin orbit coupling. That's important when you have triplet superconductivity because you have a spin. And what it means is if I rotate the lattice, I have simultaneously to rotate the spin. So if I have my K vector, I do a rotation, then I have simultaneously to rotate the K vector and the D vector. And in addition, this is a layered material, so pairing is mainly in the plane of the layered material. If I call this the C-axis here, then I have pairing with Kx, Ky, but I leave out Kc. And under this condition, I can write down the possible pairing states. I can classify them now not with respect to the angular momentum. In a crystal lattice, angular momentum has gone, of course. And so I have to use the representations of the tetragonal lattice symmetry. So it's a discrete group. And so we have five irreducible representations, four one-dimensional ones, and one two-dimensional group. And so if I write down what are the possible states, then, I get this collection here. have these one-dimensional ones, they have a k-dependent d vector, so they are like the b phase in helium-3. If you have a basically cylindrical Fermi surface, they have no nodes. If you look at this state here, the U representation, it has two basis states. Now, there are various configurations for them, and there is one configuration which is most stable, and that is this configuration, Z times Kx plus Iky, or the time-reversed part. And also, this has no nodes, and this is obviously the A phase of helium-3. That's A phase-like. Now, the question is, which one of these is stabilized? So in three dimensions, if we look at the states which we have here, we could clearly identify the B phase as the most stable one because it had no nodes. Here we have the situation that we have the degeneracy, and this degeneracy is just due to the fact that the condensation energy in weak coupling is basically minus one-half times the density of states at the Fermi level, assuming this is now just a constant, times the gap in square averaged over the Fermi surface.
So, Manfred, how cylindrical a Fermi surface do you need to argue that there is no AC dependent? The experimental data is a little bit AC.
Oh yeah, that there is definitely some KC dependence, but it is in a way that basically the out-of-plane component for the pairing is rather weak. So it would not affect the symmetry of the state. So I would have to multiply here with a certain function of which is C dependent, but which would not so it would be a state of the so this would be a function which corresponds to one A1G is a completely symmetric function of KC, and then that's still fine. We would have the same.
Would the KC is either or odd, you can change.
Yeah, but so you should not make this odd. Otherwise, if this is odd, then we are in an even parity state. So and then I should not write it with D vectors anyway. So.
Yeah. KC even also would make an isotropic gap in the KC direction.
It would be slightly anisotropic, yeah.
So that would be somewhat unstable.
Then now the question is, of course, which state has which KC dependence. So I leave that point out because we don't know. So we have only this. We have basically we can start with a cylindrical Fermi surface. If you look at the pairing interactions which you have, then of course you can generate all these states out of a pairing interaction on an equivalent level. And so this KC dependence would be everywhere anyway, also the same. But now the problem is, if you look at this, for all the D vectors which we have here, this is just kx squared plus ky squared. It's for all the same. This means that we have a degeneracy of the condensation energy. And so we cannot decide on this basis which one is the most stable state. This is the same situation you have in helium-3, where you have, for helium-3, when you have a helium-3 film and it's superfluid. And so now, you need an additional mechanism to split this degeneracy, and the most likely mechanism is spin orbit coupling. And that's an interesting aspect because we have here, as I said before, we have three different bands. They are in this T to G level. Actually, spin orbit coupling here has a very nice form, and so it has been investigated what kind of spin orbit coupling or what kind of conditions would be necessary to stabilize the different states. Now, before just saying something about this, let me go on, and so now just not trying from theoretical point of view argue which state is most stable, but look at the experiment. And so let's look at the experiments, the early experiments which tell us what symmetry is realized here. And so one experiment, of course, you have to do when you look at the spin triplet pairing is you have to find the spin of the Cooper pairs. You have to see, has the Cooper pair really a spin? If it has not, if it's a spin singlet pair, of course, if you apply a magnetic field, then in order to spin polarize the electrons, you have to break up the Cooper pair. And so what we know already shortly after the BCS theories came out, Yoshida actually showed that you get below TC a deviation from the Pauli sensibility in a metal. It goes down. It goes down to zero at zero temperature. So the spin polarizability is completely suppressed. Now for a triplet superconductor, if you have here the Pauli spin sensibility, here is TC, you find the same kind of drop if the D vector is parallel to the applied field. If the field, if the D vector is perpendicular to the applied field, then it would stay constant. And so this kind of experiment has been done in, by Ishida and co-workers. And they found no drop for the field lying in the plane perpendicular to the D-axis. So from this experiment, Ishida's experiment, we could say the D-vector is parallel to C. There are later experiments which indicate that the same thing would happen also for fields being parallel to the C-axis, but these will be part of the debate in this workshop, whether this really shows what is the first interpretation in which you would get. But
excuse me, so what's the strength of the field used in this original spin susceptibility experiment?
Oh, they have used various strengths. I'm not sure, but I think they went down to around 100 oersted for these fields along the C-axis.
200.
Or 200 oersteds, yeah. So, and you can go very high up, actually the maximal TC is, at the maximal HC2 is around 1 Tesla. So you can look at quite a bit of field range. The second experiment, which has also been done very quickly, was actually Muesar, zero field relaxation. That was done by Luke and co-workers. And what you do in this experiment is you have no field, as the zero field here indicates. You inject spin-polarized muons and you look at the depolarization rate of these. And so this gives you a measure of the intrinsic field spread in the material. And so what this found is the following. So that's here. So to say, the depolarization rate, and so you get more or less a constant here, and then it decreases below TC. It's growing. This indicates that the superconducting state is producing its own magnetism, and so this would indicate that you break time reversal symmetry. So this has gone. And so already for these two experiments, they consistently point to one state. It's this state here, the A phase. It's, first of all, it is a state where the D vector is pointing along the C axis. Secondly, it has an intrinsic angular momentum, and so it breaks time reversal symmetry. So let's look at this D state. What are the properties? the C, having a vector along the C-axis means we have the spins of the Cooper pair lying in the basal plane. This is a triplet state with SZ equals zero. So this is 1 over square root 2, spin up, spin down, plus spin down, spin up. And for this reason, if you have a field in the plane, you can easily polarize, spin polarize the electronic spins without destroying the Cooper pairs. Now, the second thing is this, so that's for the spin part. The orbital part has now an angular momentum, LZ plus or minus 1. And so it's this basically which gave the name chiral to this state. So we have this chirality built in. And this, of course, since we have electrons which are charged particles, would also be responsible for the magnetism which we see in the muon. In the minimum zero field relaxation measurements. This state has, of course, degeneracy 2. And for that reason, unlike, for example, the high TC state, the dx squared minus y squared state, or the conventional superconductors, it could also have could have domain formation. That's another interesting aspect which we will look at in this workshop. But it has also, I have to make space. It has also some other interesting aspect, and that is that it has an order parameter with two components. So the usual order parameter which you use, for example, in describing a superconducting state within Ginzburg-Landau theory has just one scalar order parameter. Here we have a two-component order parameter. That's, of course, already given by the fact that the state actually results from the two-dimensional representation of this crystal symmetry. And so if you write your D vector in general, then of course you have an X component. You can write it like that on the Y component. So these are two complex components. And so eta X, eta Y can then be eta naught 1 plus minus I in its most simple formulation. Now the question is, of course, can you see that you have two components in experiment? And so there is one experiment which has to do with the flux distribution in the mixed phase, and this is also be discussed in this workshop. So the flux distribution in the mixed phase, you have vortices in there. You can measure that with muons also. And so there are certain subtle points in the distribution of the magnetic field which you would not get with a single component order parameter. This was actually theoretically investigated by Achterberg, and he will also, I think, shortly talk about this during the workshop. Then the next experiment is ultrasound. When you go through a second order phase transition, then Ehrenfest relations tell you that for certain ultrasound modes, you can get a renormalization of the sound velocity. For superconductors, this is usually the longitudinal mode which gets, so for one component order parameters, it's the longitudinal sound wave mode which has a renormalization of sound velocity. However, if you have two components, you have much more possibilities to fluctuate. And so there is here one mode where the magnitude of the two order parameters fluctuate against each other. And this allows you to have a renormalization of the transverse sound mode. And so this will also be discussed, really, whether the experiments tell us this result. There were some preliminary results many years ago, but I think this has not been completely clarified. And so this will be also discussed.
This is also true for conventional multiple components to conduct?
No, usually not. So if you look at the... I wouldn't see how you do that, because by symmetry you cannot couple to the transverse mode there, so it's rather easily to see what are the matrix elements which you need in order to couple here. So I will briefly, during the workshop, I will show what are the conditions that you couple to transverse mode. And a last thing, which is just a proposal of an experiment, is uniaxial stress. If you apply uniaxial stress in the basal plane, of course you break the degeneracy of the two components, and then of course it's possible to have more than one superconducting transition. So you split up the transition into two. So the possibility of a double transition, superconducting transition. This has been tried but not successful so far, because so we also don't know really how big should be the uniaxial stress really to see something. It's not a really easy experiment. Mostly destroy your sample. So now what? One thing which was a very nice thing about D-wave superconductors, so the high temperature superconductors, were these nodes which you have in these states. And so you could see these nodes in various thermodynamic properties. For example, the London penetration depth at low temperatures, NMR, T1 over T1 measurements. And so the reason that you see some distinction between this and an isotropic gap is, in an isotropic gap, the quasar particle density is just through activation over the gap. And so if you look, for example, at something like the specific heat, then this has this characteristic exponential behavior, as you know also from semiconductors where you have a gap. However, if you have nodes, then you get low-lying states, and then this is usually going into some characteristic power law. For line nodes like we have it there, it is a T square for the specific heat. For point nodes, it would be a T cube. Now the question, of course, was also here, would we see some nodes? And so if you look at these states here, just looking at the spherical, at the cylindrical Fermi surface, you do not expect any nodes by symmetry. Here, by symmetry, there must be nodes, because you have a sign change there, we wouldn't have any nodes. Now, this is also an issue which we will discuss, and I write it under the term complications. Nodes, we see actually power laws in specific heat, in heat transport, in the London penetration depth, and actually also in NMR and so on. They would be compatible with, some of them at least are compatible with line nodes. And so the question is where this is coming from. Or the question is that really true? Do we see power laws? Power laws as clean as we have them in the high TC superconductors. And the problem about complications I write up here is that we have here actually a multiband system. And so the gap on different Fermi surfaces may be very different. And so the analysis of these thermodynamic quantities is actually a highly complicated thing. So you have enough fitting parameters that you can fit basically everything. So we have to see really, are these power laws telling us something, or are these power laws just a kind of fake? Then the other complication which I just mentioned before, there is no drop of high four fields parallel to the z-axis. And so this is a recent result by Ishida's group. And so this means we have here the situation when we take it serious, so that basically h is parallel to the d vector, we would expect the drop, and we don't see them this in the experiment. And so there are various ideas have come up why this is not the case. One, of course, is that the drop is not visible due to the fact that along the c-axis, the fields which we are allowed to apply are very small, because we have a rather low HC2, but also the field, the modulation of the order parameter is very big along this direction, and so we would not have really a clean result. But on the other hand, of course, we know that this situation here is most stable. If the d vector can be flipped by the magnetic field, of course, we would exactly get a constant spin sensibility. So the question is, how big a field would we need? And so now the issue of how big is the splitting among these different states. You see, all these B phase states have their D vector lying in the basal plane. So how big is the splitting of these D states compared to the A state due to spin orbit coupling? And so rough estimates tell us that delta TC over TC is of the order of 1 to 5%. It's very tiny, and we would say it's probably easy to flip. But the critical field to flip, so H flip, is of the order, if you estimate, of 1 kilohertz state. And that's higher than the HC2 along this direction. So we don't really know in what situation we are here. And so this is also an issue which we will discuss during the workshop. Now I have to a little bit hurry up, because I would like to say, of course, something about chirality and the issue of time reversal symmetry breaking here. So the broken time reversal symmetry, of course, is one of the most exciting features here. And so let me just quickly say some general aspects about this. So we have somehow an internal angular momentum of the Cooper pairs, and we may define this internal angular momentum in the following way. So we have here psi h bar, then you make such a kind of matrix element with the d vector. Oh, sorry, here is that are the different components with sum over nu. That defines an internal angular momentum. Wolowick and Gorkov have many years ago classified these states, and they distinguished the situation where L of k averaged over the Fermi surface is finite. They call this ferromagnetic or chiral. And the situation where L of k averaged over k, oh, sorry, that is not zero, is zero, that they called antiferromagnetic. So, in quotation marks, so this is non-chiral. Now, our state here is obvious. If we put this A-phase-like state in, we get an L pointing along the C-axis, plus, or that's a positive or minus, positive or negative direction, depending on the state. And so this is definitely ferromagnetic. Now, of course, such a state, due to the fact that it has charge, unlike the helium-3, of course, has also this A phase. It has no charge. It has this angular momentum, but it has no charge, so it would not produce a magnetic moment. But here we would produce a magnetic moment, which we would say that magnetic moment is basically pointing along the C-axis and is roughly mu Bohr per Cooper pair. And this was already in the time of the helium-3. In helium-3, of course, it was the question of the angular momentum. Is this, in which way this is showing up? Do we really see a magnetic moment which corresponds to the density of Cooper pairs? And that's actually not really so. And the problem is that the Cooper pairs are huge objects. They overlap with each other. And so they are not like tightly bound molecules of electrons which rotate around each other. Otherwise, of course, the situation would be clear. And so the issue here is actually quite a bit more complicated. And I think a nice view on that is due to Wolowick, who showed that if I have this D vector of this form, so I can write this as delta naught C K times e to the I theta, where so plus or minus I theta. This is the angle in the KX KY plane. And now you have two symmetries. One is just to rotate the system by the angle theta, and so this means just you multiply your d vector by theta. That's rotation. The other is you make a U1 gauge phase transformation, and that means you multiply your d vector by a phase. And you see immediately that's the same thing. So if you look now at this, you have a conserved charge. The charge Q, which is L set minus N half. That's the number, the charge or the particle number operator. So this charge is conserved. And this gives you now a nice view on that. If you have your material, which has this phase in, it's not so easy to say what is the magnetic moment of that, but it is easy to say that if you take out the Cooper pair, which has its magnetic moment like that, then you changed the moment of the total system just by that quantity. And so if you use that concept, you get, for example, anomalous electromagnetism, for example, approximately, for a charge fluctuations, you get E in. So now you look at a planar system you have here, you introduce here a charge, you get E squared over HC times BC, a magnetic field pointing out here, out of the plane. Or you get a current, which is E squared over H times electric field times C. So if you have a current, you have a transverse electric field here. And so these are these here, these equalities are approximate. This is of course here non-dissipative because the J and the E are perpendicular, and you can, for example, here imagine that you get something like a spontaneous Hall effect, that you in the superconducting phase, if you run a current, you get a transverse voltage. However, it would be misleading to use now these relations here because there are complications in the superconductor. The superconductor is not rigid against currents, so the currents are flowing at the surface. So what is the actual moment which we see? And so the actual moment, we could, for example, ask, what is the Zeeman energy we get when we apply a magnetic field? And so if you look at this actual moment, you find that this effective moment is proportional to the condensation energy derived with respect to mu. This is roughly condensation energy divided by EF times the magnetic moment, which we had actually introduced here. So you get a very strong reduction. This here is of the order bandwidth. This here is just the condensation energy of the superconductor. That's very tiny. Now, I see that I basically used up my time, and so let me just briefly sketch one important issue, and that is, if I have such a state, such a Kyle P wave state, I have some special properties at the surface. And the special property at the surface is that I can, if I look at my Fermi surface, on this Fermi surface, the gap has a structure which where its phase depends on the angle where I am, in which direction in K-space here I'm looking. If this is now here a surface here, and I look at scattering of quasi-particles at the surface. So an electron, for example, comes in that direction. So on this Fermi surface, it's here. It's reflected back into the system, so it's scattered over here. And so the gap function has a different phase in the different directions. Now, in a superconductor, if you inject an electron, you get back a hole if the electron has energy below the gap. This is the so-called Andreev reflection. And this Andreev particle would come back here and retrace the path of the electron. So there we have this Andreev reflection. Now you can ask at the surface, what energy would such a state have? And so you can do various calculation. You can use Bogle-Deschenes type, so inhomogeneous mean field calculation. You can use simple Bohr-Sommerfeld type of approximations. So what you find is actually that you get an electron spectrum which is delta the gap magnitude times k parallel, that's the momentum along this direction here. And so if you write down the spectrum here, that's Kf minus Kf here along this direction, you have a spectrum which looks like that for the quasi-particles. So here we have the gap, delta naught, also 2 delta naught. This here is these are allowed states. And so if we now look at the these states here, yeah, it should be straight. We have these states which have a velocity only in one direction. If we would have the opposite sign here, we would have just simply the opposite spectrum. Now, if you look here at zero temperature, you would see that only these states here are occupied below the zero momentum. And then you would have only electrons moving in that direction, holes moving in the other direction, and you would have a net electric current flowing in that direction. So these states, which are chiral subgap states, carry a current. And so if I draw this now here, this is now, say, x, if that is the x direction. And so we have here such a current flowing along the y direction, if that is the y direction here. And this here is the length scale xi. Now, this would induce a magnetic field which would be constant inside the superconduction. That cannot happen. And so what we get here is actually, in addition, on a length scale, lambda, we have screening. And so we would have these states, so this magnetic field B pointing along the C-axis, it would decay towards the inside of the system. And so this is an other issue, that at the surface of these superconductors, we would expect to see magnetic flux. And the question is, could we see this in experiments? So far, there is no clear result about that. This is another topic of this workshop. And so, to finally conclude here, I would like to say that this, nevertheless, although we don't have a clear insight, or we have a clear result on these surface currents, we know that there are surface states, because in quasi-particle tunneling, you can see them. Because if you look at the conventional superconductor, and you look at the spectrum dI, dV, as a function of the voltage, you see something like that. So you have a dip in the conductance, in the quasi-particle tunneling conductance, of the width of the gap. However, due to these states here, you have very different behavior. So it actually goes down here, coming from outside, and you have a big hump here in the center, so-called zero bias anomaly. Due to these surface states. And this feature has been observed. So
can this be also different mode?
This can also be, so in this structure, not quite. So notes,
if due to time, we should hold the discussion.
Yeah. So this would be, for notes, it would be highly peaked. So there are a lot of other things to talk about, but I seemingly miscalculated my time, and I should probably stop here and take your questions. Yeah, that's the part which I just skipped. Yeah. So high TC, I think, has not been done so far, but there are Josephson tunneling measurements between conventional superconductors like lead or indium, I think, was used by Ying Liu's group. And so you can even do phase-sensitive tests like you have for the high-temperature superconductors. So in high-temperature superconductors, one of the important experiments that really establish is plus-minus type of gap structure was that you could do Josephson coupling in two perpendicular directions and then see the interference effect due to the phase shift, the pi phase shift. Now, in this case here, so in this case for the B wave, so you go into perpendicular direction, and then you make interference effects. For the case of a triplet superconductor, actually the interesting situation, that's the P wave and that's S superconductor, is this situation here. And so here you get a pi phase shift if you have a P wave state. To show how it works is rather complicated, because you have to introduce spin orbit coupling. Here you have triplet spin configuration, you have singlet. So in order to get a finite matrix element, you have to have spin active tunneling here at the Fermi surface. So here, so you see a pipe phase shift, and Yun Liu has in his experiment seen that. Interesting is if you go perpendicular to it, you see arbitrary phase shift. And that is an indication of time reversal symmetry breaking. Now, this is also something which we will discuss because, as I mentioned before, we have this twofold degeneracy. Somewhere gone. But so, and we could have domain walls in this material, and then the question is what these domain walls will do to this experiment. So this is something which has to be discussed also during these 2 weeks. Yep.
So the fact that there are three bands probably is a cause of complication. Now, how much do we know about which band contributes to superconductivity strongest, or which one goes first?
So there are ideas about which one is strongest. So I have shown you this band structure here. So if I plot it now in a little bit more professional way, it looks like that. So I have something called alpha, beta band, and then I have a gamma band which looks like this. And so the alpha beta bands recruit from these two orbitals, and the gamma band is a dx, so this is a dzx, dyz, and this is a dxy. Band. This is the heaviest band. These are lighter bands. They are quasi one-dimensional. That's why I drew it in that way. They show strong incommensurate magnetic fluctuations. Now, if I theoretically want to split up this degeneracy here by spin orbit coupling, it's easy to do within this subspace. It's like a P orbital. And so then you find that in order to get the A phase, you need dominant superconductivity in this orbital. Now, the experiments which we have looking at this specific heat and other quantities are consistent with having this band here dominant or active. And these are then only passive and would have a gap, so estimated gap roughly 20 to 30% only of the dominant gap. And then you could fit most of the this stuff here.
So I wanted to make a clarification for non-experts, actually.
Yeah.
When you said that there's no clear result on the existence of the spontaneous currents at the surface,
yeah.
I guess I have the impression that there is a clear result which disagrees strongly with the magnitude that one would expect in these materials.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So,
that's our debate which we'll have to do next week.
And then this afternoon we're going to talk about, I hope there'll be a lively discussion of what are the possible causes of that, and then what could the MuSR be seeing?
Yeah.
I have a very mundane question. In talking about the analogy to helium 3, you said that Swan-Chambliss is a Fermi
liquid state.
And are there experiments on Swan-Chambliss in the normal state? You know, helium 3 is quintessential Fermi liquid. Are there similar detailed measurements of effective mass things and with similar theoretical work showing that the edifice holds?
So I mean, Strunz-Mürzenheit has one of the most beautiful de Haspin-Alten measurements for a strongly correlated Fermi liquid. So you know every wrinkle on the Fermi surface.
And who did this and when were this?
This was done in Andy McKenzie's group. Christoph Bergemann did this detailed analysis. And I think next week Andy will talk about this.
So, I think we will stop here.
I just wanted to make one announcement, if that's okay.
Okay, after. Yeah, I mean, that's first time. Okay. Thank you again for a very short.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think most of you.